As we battle the COVID-19 crisis today, we also take a step back to break down one of the worst climate crises in U.S. history.
The people of the Gulf Coast need our help, and they deserve nothing less than for us to stand up and do whatever is necessary.
This oil threatens not only our coast and our wetlands, this oil fundamentally threatens our way of life.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for April 21st, a look at the BP oil spill 10 years ago and its effects still felt today. Also, how the lack of federal funding forced many small businesses around the country to miss out on loans.
I'm here waiting. I have submitted every document they wanted. I have jumped over every hoop. We are drowning and we need the government's help.
Then we speak with Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot about her city's response to COVID-19 and the racial disparities playing out during the pandemic. All right, let's get going.
Coast Guard here in New Orleans received a call that MODU, the Mobile Offshore Drilling Unit, Deepwater Horizon, had an explosion and a fire.
Giant oil rig which exploded and burned and now has sunk into the ocean off the coast of Louisiana. A new problem, thousands of barrels of crude oil flooding into the Gulf of Mexico.
So let me be clear. BP is responsible for this leak. BP will be paying the bill.
Sorry for the massive disruption it's caused to their lives. And, you know, there's no one who wants this thing over more than I do. You know, I'd like my life back.
All my fishermen is very, very worried about the oil spill.
I see on TV the birds drenched in oil, the fishermen out of work, the massive oil spill, the oil slick destroying our precious ecosystem.
A big suction cup.
The bottom off of a milk cart.
A big chimney.
A bucket over a fire hose.
A huge coffee cup.
The big idea to fix the oil spill that's gushing from the underwater well is to cover it. Seems a little late.
The people of the Gulf Coast need our help, and they deserve nothing less than for us to stand up and do whatever is necessary to stop this spill, prevent further damage, and compensate all those who've been harmed already.
This week marked 10 years since the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. The Deepwater Horizon explosion killed 11 people working on the rig and injured countless others. Tens of thousands of birds, fish, sea turtles, and other wildlife also died in the aftermath. The massive spill polluted thousands of miles of coastline from Florida to Texas and left local fisheries and other industries in ruins. The BP oil spill was, and still is, one of the worst environmental disasters in U.S. history. At the time, I was reporting from Louisiana on the immediate aftermath of the oil spill. I was there for almost 4 months, and to this day, I'm still haunted by some of the things I saw. Drowning dolphins, oil on beaches, men whose friends were killed. And while we don't see the most visible effects of the disaster, the Gulf region is far from a full recovery. We're still learning the long-term effects on everything, from the loss of bird populations to oil pollution in the water, despite spending billions of dollars on cleanup efforts in the decades since. For more on the 10th anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon explosion, we're joined by Lisa Friedman, a climate change reporter for the New York Times. Lisa, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Frances Beinecke, former president of the Natural Resources Defense Council and a member of the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling. Frances, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I want to start with you, Frances. You were a member of this bipartisan commission that found systematic failures of risk management on the part of BP, Transocean, Halliburton were the immediate cause of the accident. But you also found that the entire industry's safety culture was a real problem. Has that changed at all?
I think one thing that has really happened is that the safeguards that were put in place by the Interior Department that were recommended by the commission were adhered to in the beginning, but it's 10 years later. We have an administration that's very interested in drilling across all our coasts. And the attention to safety and precautionary measures that we strongly recommended, I think, have been put very much on hold, as well as very specific rollbacks in the regulations that were put in place.
Can you talk to me about some of those regulations that were put in place and then what was rolled back?
Well, there were two in particular. One around the blowout for the Deepwater Horizon, and the other was the well control rule, which took many years to figure out the engineering and the design of that new rule. It was finalized in 2016, and the Trump administration has weakened it since.
Lisa, you recently spoke with Francis and the other commission members for the New York Times. In terms of what we saw from those recommendations, what sense of them have translated into permanent policies?
When I spoke to all of the commissioners, they kind of divided when I talked to them about their reflections about where we stand now and how much safer we are or aren't, divided things into how industry has done, how Congress has done, and how the administration has done. And for the most part, a number of commissioners really seem to take this accident to heart. A lot of the big companies did make safety improvements, particularly in containment. Where I found the greatest frustrations were, as you might expect, in the rollbacks to the well control rule. Most acutely, I think, also the lack of action that Congress has taken over the past 10 years.
So I guess I wonder, Francis, do you think the U.S. is better prepared today than it was 10 years ago for something like this, if it happens again?
I think this could happen again. I think we're marginally better prepared, but I think you never know what the next accident is going to be. So we work very hard at ensuring that there was a proposals for a widespread change in the culture of the industry so they would be prepared for any kind of an accident. I think what happens after a spill or an event of this magnitude is you're prepared in the beginning and then time passes and you know, people relax their attention to it. So it's a high-risk event, but doesn't happen often. So I think this could happen again, and I am worried that we would not be adequately prepared for it.
One thing I was really struck by when I covered this was a big tug of war over who was in charge, whether the government was or BP was. Who should bear responsibility, Francis, in a disaster like this?
Well, I think the thing that was very important here was that BP did bear responsibility. The Coast Guard took responsibility for managing the operation on the ground, but BP was responsible, was financially responsible, and has paid out over $60 billion in the aftermath of this spill. And I think one thing that is incredibly worrisome is there are very few companies with that kind of deep pocket. If this happened again, it was a smaller company, who would bear the brunt of the cost of that? And in fact, that's why preparedness is so important, because we can't afford this kind of a spill. The environment can't afford it. The workers can't afford it. The states can't afford it. And we have to do everything we can to prevent it from happening again.
Lisa, oil has been on everybody's mind in the past day or so as we've seen prices plunge. And I guess I'm curious, offshore drilling really collapsed after this explosion, but we've seen a resurgence in production over the past few years. What does production look like today?
It has surpassed pre-accident levels by a few hundred thousand barrels a day. My colleague Cliff Krause, who covers the oil industry closely, you know, he noted that oil companies brought 7 new projects online in 2019, and you know, 9 more were expected this year. But you know, I think there's going to be a rethinking of investments. But you know, production growth has gone up dramatically. The agency that is supposed to be separate from the agency focusing on oil production made a point of, under this administration, issuing a press release to applaud a recent, you know, record 2 billion barrels a day of total U.S. production.
You know, you mentioned Congress earlier, Lisa, and I guess I wonder, are there things that they were working on and then have shelved? I imagine that is sort of still on hold given everything else that's happening.
There's a number of things that Congress hasn't done, and now everything has been shelved, you know, in light of the coronavirus disaster. I think, you know, some of the big things that were posed to me were, you know, Congress never formally divided BSEE, the Bureau of Safety and Enforcement, from a separate agency that is supposed to be more focused on production. And, you know, while the Obama administration did that, as we've learned from regulations, things done by executive order can be easily undone or subject to the whims of a next administration. So there's a lot of people who feel that that agency is remains vulnerable.
Frances, I want to talk about the sort of irony here that you mentioned in funding, right? The money that has gone to restore the coastline has come largely from oil companies. Is there any way to disentangle that funding stream?
Well, I think right now everybody is short of funding. The economy is in shatters. And, you know, fortunately, there was a huge amount of money made available because of this spill, and it did go into restoration. And the need is great. And remember, it's not just the damage from the spill. There's tremendous damage, erosion, subsidence from years and years and decades of drilling down there. So the oil industry should be responsible for the damage that has been incurred over the long term of drilling in that region. And fortunately, the money is going to restoration, and particularly the state of Louisiana, which had quite a comprehensive plan for restoration, but no way to fund it. Now, literally billions of dollars are heading in that direction for Louisiana. But let me just say that the Gulf Coast is at risk, not only from the oil and gas industry, but from the consequences of climate change and sea level rise. So it's a very vulnerable part of this country.
Lisa, just quickly, as we mentioned at the top, the oil spill devastated ecosystems and economies in the Gulf. But there was a new study in February that showed that some of this damage is even worse than we initially thought. What can you tell us about invisible oil and what it did?
Sure. I mean, we are still learning about the consequences of the deepwater spill. I would just say, you know, for example, right, one study that just came out a few weeks ago found fish in the Gulf of Mexico are still contaminated with oil a decade later.
Frances Beinecke is the former president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Lisa Friedman is a climate change reporter for The New York Times. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The Takeaway is committed to covering climate change all this week as part of a collaboration with hundreds of other media outlets and organizations. This project is called Covering Climate Now, and you can find all our coverage at thetakeaway.org/coveringclimatenow. Last week, a judge in Montana canceled a key permit for the controversial Keystone XL pipeline just 2 weeks after the project started construction. It had taken years for construction to begin, and it was expected to stretch from Canada all the way to Nebraska. The judge said the Army Corps of Engineers failed to take into consideration endangered species that would be affected by the pipeline. But construction will continue at the U.S.-Montana border and may start in other areas like South Dakota as soon as this month. Tribal leaders along the route of construction argue that construction in the middle of a pandemic is unnecessary and are worried it may lead to the disease spreading in their communities. I spoke with Anthony Swift.
I'm the director of NRDC's Canada Project.
That's the Natural Resources Defense Council. And Faith Spotted Eagle.
My Indian name is Standing Stone from Yankton Sioux, Ihanktuma.
I asked Anthony to remind us of the contentious history of the pipeline.
There's been a 10-year conflict over this pipeline, and one of the reasons, well, I would say that we've seen enormous opposition in the United States and Canada, in many parts of Canada, to the project due to its environmental impacts the communities. It was rejected by President Obama in 2015 because he found it was not in the nation's national interest. When the Trump administration came into power, they took a number of measures to try to just push this pipeline through. And what we found is time and time again, attempts to skirt environmental laws, attempts to skirt the public opportunities to comment in processes like Keystone XL have actually created new delays. You know, the Trump administration's efforts to push the project through the National Environmental Policy Act has resulted in a number of legal defeats in federal court. And what has happened most recently is, the Trump administration attempted to use a streamlined process to avoid environmental review and an evaluation of impacts to endangered species when it granted permits for the 700 water crossings that Keystone would take.
What does this latest ruling mean for the pipeline as a whole?
The project sponsor, TC Energy, formerly TransCanada, can no longer build the pipeline on any of the 700 waterways along its pipeline route in the United States. So that effectively, it makes it very difficult for the project to move forward with construction.
Faith, you're in South Dakota. What has the reaction on the ground been to this ruling?
I think it's just an affirmation of what we have been saying to the Corps and the other feds over and over again, that the nationwide permit and the endangered species was not even touched. And when we would say it in communication after communication with the endangered species, they would totally ignore it. They'd sit there with stone faces, nod their heads, take their notes, and then go on their merry way. So it is especially delicious for us on the ground here to be able to have them called on that whole issue of our four-legged, the wing, the swimming relatives, and we're pretty happy about that.
Anthony, this ruling is certainly a hurdle, as you both have said, but does this mean the company can't build at all?
Well, it is an enormous challenge because the pipeline simply cannot operate without those 700 river crossings and waterway crossings. And the way these pipelines are constructed, they're constructed in very large segments. You know, the company builds man camps that bring in, you know, hundreds of workers to build hundreds of miles of pipeline routes. And so to begin construction with a bunch of segments, you know, 700 segments, creates what would appear to be an insurmountable obstacle to the project moving forward.
Faith, we're in this obviously delicate moment where COVID-19 is affecting communities around the world. And I guess I wonder, how does the construction that has already been happening affect indigenous communities that are along the various building routes?
Our Indian Health Service is understaffed, underfunded, underlocated to begin with, and we do not have the capacity for our current health needs, in addition to the threat by the virus coming. Something happened this past week that caused us to divide. There was $8 billion that was set aside for Native people. The Alaskan Federation of Natives came in and asked for that money, which would potentially split it in half because the federations in Alaska are not tribes. So what they've done is they've pitted us against each other because it's going to reduce the amount of funding that we get in half. So there's always a contrived basis, number one, in a colonized way to set us against each other, and then to not honor treaty rights, because the healthcare, health, education, and welfare is what my grandfather signed up for when he gave 200 million acres away in eastern South Dakota, which is a sad statement to say. But our people trusted that all of the treaty signers, which is all United States, every citizen of the United States is a treaty signer because they signed our treaty. It's not just us that. So if there's anybody listening out there, please honor your treaty right, your individual treaty right that the government signed in the 1800s, in the 1851 treaty. You were violating it over and over and over again.
Faith, you've been active in the fight against this pipeline for a while, and I guess I wonder what kind of historical parallels you're seeing in this current situation.
Well, obviously, in the 1800s, the government actually shipped us smallpox through blankets. They knew that these blankets were infected. And so it's the very same thing. They're sending thousands of men who could trust them to monitor their people when they've lied to us? I ask you that. Why would anybody trust them when time and time they don't tell the truth?
Anthony, why is the company pushing for construction now during a pandemic anyway?
The reality is there is no urgency to build this pipeline aside from the fact that, you know, the company very well may be trying to build as much of it as possible before a favorable president leaves office. I think that there is a sense that the Trump administration has been trying to push this pipeline through, and there's a narrow window, and I think they're a little concerned that a new government might begin to take a more rigorous look at the pipeline and evaluate its risks versus rewards for the American people and come to the same conclusion that the Obama administration came to.
You know, one group that is supporting the pipeline has said, well, if people pull out, this would cause more uncertainty about investing in infrastructure projects. Do they have a point?
The reality is it's impossible to make the case that Keystone XL and tar sands expansion are consistent with our international climate goals. It transports a type of oil that we don't have spill response techniques to clean, and we've seen that in a number of devastating tar sands spills in the United States and Canada. And so, you know, the reality is there are many infrastructure projects that have clear benefits for the American people. And not moving forward with projects like Keystone XL only shows that our environmental review process is working, because the reality is there are good infrastructure projects and there are bad ones. And this is a bad one.
Faith, what are your thoughts on the timing of all of this?
I think there's no doubt that our governor is working with Trump and the other governors surrounding us, because there's a block of states in this area that have refused from the governor's viewpoints to declare a shelter in place. And our governor says that everybody else is following herd mentality. I think that's a projection of what she's doing. All five of those governors are following herd mentality because they want this pipeline and they want the economy to go through. And I think that's what Noam's plan is, despite the fact that we have the largest concentration of COVID occurrence in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, in the packing plant, Smithfield Foods. And so in spite of that, she's saying that we have the common sense to take care of this ourselves, which is literally pushing us into danger. And I think that she's pretty well set that she is just following Trump. And then I think the other thing is that she had riot boosting laws that she pushed through the state legislature 2 years ago, and a judge found those unconstitutional. So she went back to the drawing board, and with this last legislative session, she pushed it through again, and she reassured, and she did it in an emergency. She forced the legislators, who are largely Republican, to accept it, saying that it would be under the letter of the law for what Judge Pearsall said. But we will see, because I'm sure that we're going to appeal that again. But those riot boosting laws that she talked about is exactly what happened in those states like Michigan. The last few days, we had protesters with guns. And then the top official, Trump, saying that people are just having cabin fever when they're walking around with guns.
Before I let you all go, Anthony, how do falling oil prices factor into all of this?
Well, it plays a significant role. I think that, you know, we've seen tar sands crude are one of the most expensive sources of oil to produce. One of the outstanding issues that has come up with the Keystone XL pipeline is that in a world with declining demand for oil, and this is a world that, you know, we have to see to avoid some of the most catastrophic impacts of climate change, sources of oil like Canada's tar sands are going to be the first to fall off of the menu, because they're both highly carbon intensive and extremely expensive to produce. And there's simply no market for tar sands in a world that has lower demand. And we're seeing that today. I mean, right now, I think on Sunday, the price of Canadian tar sands went negative. Producers actually had to pay people to take it off their hands. So it's just another clear reason why a pipeline with this many environmental issues associated with it is really not needed.
Anthony Swift and Faith Spotted Eagle, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega. Small business owners remain some of the hardest hit by COVID-19. To help, the federal government put $349 billion behind the Paycheck Protection Program back in March as part of its coronavirus relief package. Run by the Small Business Administration, the program was designed to provide forgivable loans to small businesses to stay afloat during the pandemic. But on Thursday, the SBA announced that the money ran out and that the program would no longer be taking applications. And a lot of small businesses around the country were shut out, frankly, we don't even know how many. Meanwhile, many big chain restaurants were able to secure loans, like Potbelly Sandwich Shop, Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, and Shake Shack. Shake Shack has since announced it will give the money back.
I own a little restaurant, bar, and one-screen movie theater called Giggle Waters.
Rachel Fine is a small business owner who applied for a PPP loan.
It's in the Tampa area in Florida, a little town called Safety Harbor.
And as Rachel told us when she joined us on the show a few weeks back, coronavirus hit at a critical time for her business.
I mean, this was prime season. This is the time of year we make our money for the rest of the year. And then all of a sudden, we were put to 50% capacity when coronavirus hit. So we went from a two-hour wait to get a table on a Friday or Saturday night to only allowing 75 people in at a time. And within a week, we were brought down to delivery or takeout only. We had to shutter the dining room. And that represents maybe 20% of our business. So we are down just an astronomical amount and doing our best to make ends meet.
So Rachel, like a lot of other business owners, applied for a forgivable loan from the Small Business Administration.
Applying for the PPP loan was ridiculous. We went on the SBA's website and we downloaded the practice application so that we could fill everything out ahead of time, we could get our ducks in a row, we would have all the information the second our bank allowed us to submit an application. And we did that. We were ready. We sat through a three-hour conference call with our bank to learn the ins and outs of the loan. We were ready to go. The second we could apply, we had everything submitted, and then the bank had some more follow-up questions, so we sent some more documentation. Then 4 days ago, I get an email from the bank, and I'm going to read it to you. He says, "Unfortunately, your loan did not get approved by the SBA before funds were maximized. If they increase the amount, you will be at the front of the line. Thank you." That was a devastating moment in my life. That would have been game-changing. Honestly, we'd already spent the money. I had rent to pay, I have bills to pay, and I have 32 employees who I am dying to hire back who are sitting home waiting for a call, and I can't hire them. I don't have the funds.
And Rachel didn't just apply for the PPP loan. She looked for help elsewhere, too.
The day after we were told that we had to shutter the doors, I applied for every single loan I could find. I applied for a traditional SBA loan, I applied for the EIDL, and let me tell you, it was not an easy process. It wasn't easy to get all the documentation together, the paperwork together, the websites crashed constantly. I ended up having to fax one application and snail mail another, and it's been weeks now, and I haven't heard from either one. So I'm doing all of the things. I am jumping through all of the hoops, and there is no help. It feels like we just gotta save ourselves, and honestly, I don't know how to do that. We're riding out the storm the best we can. I'm down to just my full-time employees and myself, so there are five of us working around the clock, serving lunch and dinner 7 days a week. It's been unbelievably difficult, and the volume from traditional sales, like I said, is only about 20%, so we've moved more to feeding the front lines. It's been something that's been personally fulfilling for us. We reach out to corporations and try to get them to sponsor meals for hospitals in the area. In the past 3 weeks, we've been able to serve over 475 first responders. People email us at events@gigglewaters.com, and they want to contribute and they want to help. And so we find a way to both move product and keep our product fresh so that we can make sure that what we are selling is good quality food by feeding as many people as possible. And for us, that's been hospitals, fire stations. On Easter, we served 6 units of Meese Countryside Hospital, and that's kind of been a passion project and something to do to just keep sane during all of this.
Now, Rachel's just hoping she won't have to submit more paperwork to be considered in the next round of government aid.
I'm here waiting. I have submitted every document they wanted. I have jumped over every hoop. We are drowning, and we need the government's help.
Congress is now negotiating a new round of funding that could provide billions of dollars more to the PPP. But as they negotiate the fine print, working towards an agreement, some people are left wondering if this second round of loans may be too little too late. Joining me now to talk about the challenges and the road ahead for the Paycheck Protection Program and small businesses is Zach Warmbrot, a financial services reporter for Politico. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First off, remind us about how the PPP was supposed to work and how these loans are a little different from traditionally getting a loan from the bank.
So when Congress created the Paycheck Protection Program, it was really looking for a way to rapidly deliver some stimulus funds to small businesses, because the idea was maybe that would be a conduit through which you could keep people getting checks, help avert layoffs, and help prevent, you know, an even deeper recession from taking hold. And so they kind of took off the shelf a small business administration model where basically you would have banks, you know, issue these loans to businesses. But in a twist to make the loans enticing, the Congress decided to allow the loan amounts to be forgiven if a business would agree to maintain its payroll. So the trade-off would be, you know, you may not want to go into debt, but, you know, if you at least agree to keep paying people, you can have the loan amount forgiven and keep your doors open. And hopefully we can bridge you to, you know, whenever the economy is going to reopen.
What were the requirements to be eligible for one of these loans?
It was mainly focused on businesses with fewer than 500 employees, though, you know, there were avenues for larger companies to also take advantage. If you wanted the loan amount forgiven, you had to agree to maintain your payroll for about 8 weeks. And you could use the money for other expenses, but they put a cap on how much you could use to pay for rent and mortgage and utilities.
Yeah, let's talk about the caps. How much money could a business get overall? And I guess you mentioned some of those restrictions sort of in how the money could be used.
So the way they designed it is you could only get a maximum of a $10 million loan. So no one could get a larger loan than that. And as for the amount that could be forgiven, they said that you would have to spend at least 75% of the forgiven amount on your payroll. So, you know, no more than 25% could go towards things like mortgage and rent and utilities.
Do we know why the rollout of this thing seems like it was such a mess?
Yeah, I would say in the days leading up to the program's launch on April 3rd, I mean, we were already writing stories about, you know, how banks were growing anxious about how this was actually going to work. I mean, you have to remember, you know, the president signed the bill, and then less than a week later, this program launched. And, you know, that wasn't a deadline necessarily set by Congress, but that was the Treasury Department, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, saying, we're going to launch this a week from now. And the issue was, you know, because you have banks who are basically on the front lines here handing out these loans, you know, they needed guidelines from the government on how to do it, especially because a program like this had never been launched before. And so what happened was it took until the night before the program launched for the SBA and the Treasury Department to actually release a rule saying how banks should handle these loans and vet them and who, and, you know, and all the eligibility requirements and the detail that banks wanted. And so then, you know, that first day came and it was really kind of a rocky launch because you had some banks that were able to get, you know, their systems together quickly enough to take applications, start processing them. Some weren't. I mean, you saw some, you know, really major banks that weren't even participating in this initially.
Yeah.
And so that's actually been a lingering problem, you know, for several days after the launch, is that the banks were still asking questions about, okay, how do we do this? And it was just kind of like a staggered rollout of, you know, guidelines and rules from the Treasury Department and the SBA. And that was compounded by the fact that, you know, this is all having to be funneled through an SBA loan approval system that's never had to deal with this load before. And so banks were experiencing crashes, you know, a series of technical problems that were basically slowing all this down and kind of clogging up the pipeline of loans.
Why go through banks anyway? Why not just have the government do this directly?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know that, you know, there were people on Capitol Hill as this bill was being written who really pushed that point of view. I think sometimes when, you know, you have these big crises, you know, sometimes, you know, policymakers will kind of take ideas that are on the shelf and, you know, to be able to move quickly. And in this case, I think that's what happened here. You know, there was an existing SBA business loan program. They call it the 7A loan program, that which basically uses the banks as a conduit. And so I think the people who wrote the legislation basically said, okay, we'll take that model, you know, put 15 times more money into it than it's ever been in it in a year, and we'll see if that works. And so I think that's how we got here. But that'll definitely be a debate after this of whether, you know, the bank model was really the most efficient way to do it.
There have been headlines that some of these big companies, Shake Shack, Potbelly, et cetera, got PPP loans. How did that happen?
The program primarily aimed at, you know, businesses with fewer than 500 employees. But, you know, as often is the case when legislation like this is being written, you know, there were carve-outs added. So, you know, there was an exemption that allowed restaurants and hotel operators and some other industries to apply if they had fewer than 500 employees per location. So that's what opened the door to companies like Shake Shack, Potbelly, Ruth's hospitality group who owns Ruth's Chris to very quickly apply for these loans and get them.
And then just quickly, where do we stand on negotiations for more funding? Are we going to see another pot of money? Are we going to see something maybe a little more permanent?
We're definitely going to see another $300 billion or so. I mean, that seems the number everyone is coalescing around right now. And so Congress could pass that, in the next couple of days. But I'm reporting based on talking to banks that, lenders only think that could last for a few days. So some are saying maybe even just 2 days, just based on the $50 billion a day burn rate they're seeing with the program so far. So, if Congress wants to keep this program going, they're going to have to come back probably a week from now and put some more money into it.
Zach Wormbrot is a financial services reporter for Politico. Thank you so much, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, my name is Jackie. I'm calling from Kannapolis, North Carolina. My husband's company, which is a solar company, did apply for the loan, and they were approved. It was for half of the amount that they had asked for, but it was enough to get them through 2 more months of salaries for their employees. They're a small company with 22 people that work there. So that they have not received the check yet, and there's no word as to when they will receive the check.
My name is Aaron, calling from Springfield, Massachusetts. This whole bailout business is a total failure and a letdown, at least as far as real small businesses go. The owner followed all the rules, spent days and weeks on the phone, doing all the paperwork, jumping through all the hoops. And now they say the money ran out. So now, in my opinion, it's up to the state government to take responsibility for the fact that they shut down the businesses forcefully. In this case, the owner literally paid out of pocket, 2 weeks emergency pay for workers with the expectation that there was going to be some serious assistance. Now that same person is completely broke and trying to get on food stamps in order to feed herself and her kids.
Hi, I'm Eric Berg, and I live in Ojai, California. As for the loans, I applied, but I never received anything. I'm lucky in some ways. As right as this pandemic was unfolding, I was moving my storefront business model to an online business model. The first 2 weeks were rough, but the last 2 weeks have been enough to keep the lights on and to keep the rent paid for now. I'm just hoping enough people keep shopping online to keep my business alive.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
As we get more data on COVID-19 cases and deaths, it's becoming increasingly clear that the virus is taking a disproportionate toll on Black communities across the U.S. The latest out of the city of Chicago is yet another reminder of these disparities. Black residents have accounted for roughly 60% of Chicago's coronavirus-related deaths, despite making up just 30% of the city's overall population. Joining me now to talk about those disparities and the city's response to the disease overall is Chicago's Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Mayor Lightfoot, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be with you.
So far, Chicago has more than 12,500 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and at least 500 deaths reported. Health officials are saying you haven't quite yet reached that peak. Do you have any sense of when cases might start to go down?
I think it's really difficult for us to predict a precise date. We're obviously making progress, as we've been saying now for a little over a week. We started out in this pandemic seeing cases doubling every 2 days, and now we're on a path where we're seeing doubling every 12 days. So that's definitely progress, but we still have a long way to go. Our modeling obviously has been evolving over time, as everyone's is, and what we are expecting is kind of a long plateau before we see a specific decrease in the number of cases. But progress is being made only because people are staying home. So the message that we're bringing to our residents is to stay the course. We have to remain diligent. People still have to stay home and avoid congregate settings.
As I mentioned at the top, the data out of Chicago shows that Black residents make up about 60% of the city's COVID-related deaths. What do you make of that disparity?
Well, first of all, it really is takes your breath away. It's hard to, on an emotional level, to process that gaping disparity.
Yeah.
But the reality is, it's not surprising because we've known for some time and we've been talking about it and trying to mitigate it, that the underlying health conditions is really what's making the difference in the COVID disparity. And by that, I mean, unfortunately, many people in the Black community, particularly older Black Chicago, have diabetes, heart disease, upper respiratory problems at a rate that is very, very different and higher than any other demographic across the city. And given that disparity and how this disease just ravages people with those underlying conditions, the result is not a total surprise, but it's still breathtakingly awful and something that we are aggressively working to address.
Well, yeah, you outlined some plans to address some of those disparities yesterday. What are some of the key components of doing that?
Well, number one, we've got to make sure that all the providers that are doing testing don't skip receiving and then reporting out demographic information. We have to be able to, as real time as possible, be able to measure the impacts and disparities that this disease is creating across our geography. So that's issue one. Then we've got to use that information to make sure that we are doing neighborhood-specific, hyper-local outreach. And we're doing that in a number of ways. We know that many of the people that are most at risk are also folks who suffer from the digital divide. So social media campaigns and TV aren't going to reach them. So we put out literally tens of thousands of pieces of material. We call them door hangers, where we've having people literally, you know, with mask and glove go door to door and hang the information on people's residences so they have that information. And we've translated it into multiple languages. The other thing that we're doing is identifying community leaders and stakeholders, one who are credible in those communities and also have a real pulse for what's going on and the ability to network within those communities. And we're bringing them into a discussion around education, healthcare access, testing, and then using the feedback loop that's been generated to identify challenges on a neighborhood level basis, and then helping elevate that to the citywide emergency operations teams that are solving problems like housing, food, all sorts of other issues that we know are plaguing many of these communities.
Are you able to, or could you frankly have been able to get masks, protective equipment out into those communities earlier?
Yes. Well, we are definitely doing a lot of work around making sure that we're getting masks and other protective equipment out to these communities, but also learning that social distancing is a challenge when you live in a household that many times is small physically or has a lot of people living in it, a lot of intergenerational family settings. So we're tailoring our messaging. It's still, you know, stay home, stay safe, but we're still trying to tailor it to meet people where they actually are. So there's a lot of good work that's coming out of this. And our resolve is not only just to respond to this temporary but deadly pandemic, but to build a structure that we can use then for the long term to address these kind of healthcare, income inequality, and other disparities across our geography.
We've heard from governors and mayors in other states about reopening plans. What's realistic for Chicago?
Well, none of that's realistic until we see a number of different things happen. Number one, we've not got to just see bending the curve. We've got to see a dramatic drop in the number of cases, the number of deaths, the number of ICU beds being occupied by COVID-positive individuals or people under investigation with COVID. We've got to have a real strategy in the ability to execute mass testing, contact tracing. So there's a lot of pieces that need to fall into place. They're certainly on the horizon and we're working to get towards them. But a lot of it, the first and foremost, has to do with making sure that we see a dramatic drop in the number of infections and deaths and hospitalizations. And we're just not there yet.
On a somewhat lighter note, you have been turned into memes, you know, Lori Lightfoot,
yes,
arms folded, telling people to stay home. Has playing along with that helped, do you think?
You know, I think it's helped in a couple of ways. It has really galvanized our city in pretty profound ways. And really, I'm getting copies of myself in memes from people all over the country. So that's been fun. But it also, we're burning in the message of why staying home to save lives is so important. You couldn't buy this kind of mass publicity. So we're both having fun with it. It's showing, I think, the innovative spirit of people here in Chicago, but it's reinforcing an incredibly important message in a very profound way. And people, I think, are embracing it. When we started tracking information about crowds, really starting in February, we were at about 59% of people were staying home on any given day. We've moved that needle now to 79% over the arc of the stay-at-home orders and other restrictions on congregate settings that we put into place. That's good news, and it coincides, almost one-to-one with what we're seeing in a slowing of the spread of this virus.
You also, went against your own guidelines and got a haircut. Isn't that a bit hypocritical when you should be leading by example?
Well, I needed a haircut, and so...
I need a haircut, but I haven't gotten one.
I took all the necessary precautions. And so I think we've moved on from this topic. Thanks very much for your time.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And we're continuing to speak with mayors and governors across the U.S. about their approaches to the pandemic. You can find all of those conversations at thetakeaway.org/localleaders. Tomorrow, San Francisco Mayor London Breed joins us. And until then, thank you so much for being with us today. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. You can find me on Twitter @LizzieO'Reilly. And this is The Takeaway. We'll talk to you tomorrow.